The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. This is our second edition of Talk About It at Parkway Central. Talk About It is basically a community forum where we discuss issues of importance to the citizens of Philadelphia. And the last one we had was in January. We talked about the Darfur situation. Tonight we have something a little closer to home, healthcare in America. And we have a distinguished panel that our moderator, John Timpain, will introduce to you. I'd like to welcome our panel and also to welcome our moderator, John Timpain. John is the commentary page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He also covers the Science and Health beat. He writes editorials and contributes essays to Currents, the Inquirer's daily Sunday Ideas section. What you may not know about John is that he has a PhD in English and spent 16 years teaching college English before he transitioned to journalism. In addition to his op-ed and perspective pieces for magazines and newspapers, John is also a published poet. Please join me in welcoming John Timpain.
Thanks very much. And it's going to be a good discussion on a very, very vital issue. Let me introduce our panel. The way we're going to work this is that after the grand introductions, we're going to work our way back down the table, and each member of the panel will give a brief presentation. And after that, we will open it up to questions. And let me begin by introducing Walter Tu, MD. He's a nationally known healthcare policy expert who has given testimony before Congress. Dr. Tu was Philadelphia Health Commissioner from 2000 to 2002 and the President of the American Public Health Association in 2005. Now a public health consultant, he lectures at the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University. Next to him is Dr. Tom Getson, Professor of Risk, Insurance, and Health Management at the Fox School of Business, Temple University, and Executive Director of the International Health Economics Association. He has also served as visiting professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy at Princeton University and the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. His textbook, Health Economics, Fundamentals, and Flow of Funds, is used in graduate and undergraduate programs throughout the world. Carol Rogers is a physician's assistant and spokeswoman at the Philadelphia Health Department. Rogers counsels women about sexual health, among other issues. She was also a Philadelphia community organizer of the Citizens Healthcare Working Group, appointed by Congress. David Grandy, MD, is a senior fellow and instructor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. In addition, David recently received a master's in public health. You go, David. And has worked on behalf of the Philadelphia Health Department to improve access to health care for all the citizens of Philadelphia. And next to David is Teen Hansen Turton, executive director of the National Nursing Centers Consortium. She also teaches health policy to nursing students in the public health master's program at LaSalle University School of Nursing, Philadelphia, and is a frequent guest speaker at the Temple University and Jefferson University Schools of Nursing. Not to be outdone, Teen recently received her law degree from Temple. You go, Teen. And finally, Dan Fee is president of the Echo Group and is a political and media strategist who has worked in Washington and Harrisburg, directing numerous successful political and issue advocacy campaigns at the local, state, and federal levels. Dan served as communications director and chief spokesman for Governor Edward G. Rendell. And since returning to Philadelphia, Dan has consulted on political campaigns, including the Philadelphia mayor's race. He has worked with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on their Cover the Insured Week effort to highlight the continuing problem of the uninsured. a stellar panel indeed, and we're going to come back down the table now with short presentations by our panel members, and we're going to start with Dan Fee.
Well, thanks for having me, and hi. My name is Dan Fee. In addition to working for the Echo Group, I run a nonprofit called Pennsylvanians United for Affordable Healthcare, which is an organization that was formed to help pass the governor's proposal, Prescription for Pennsylvania. Prescription for Pennsylvania was proposed in January of last year, and it was designed to be a comprehensive plan to address all of the facets of health care, lower costs, expand access, it works in a number of different ways. There is such things certainly as expanding access through expanding the role of nurse practitioners, which is very much needed in rural and urban areas. Also to expand the access to affordable health care. The governor's original proposal was cover all Pennsylvanians. There is insurance reform. There is quality controls over hospitals and health care to try and lower the costs. And all of the pieces fit together. One of the things that the program was designed around was that although all of the pieces stood on their own, they really were designed to work together to overall lower costs and expand access. And so far we've been pretty successful. Almost all of the proposals passed. Some would argue that the hard pieces are left, which is sort of how it always goes, but there are two remaining aspects that haven't been passed. The nurse practitioner aspects have all been passed. A lot of the quality improvements have been passed. The two outstanding pieces are creating an affordable health insurance program that people can purchase. In some cases, individuals and small businesses will be subsidized. And the insurance reforms. Both of those have passed the State House, and we are trying to get them passed through the State Senate right now. Since the very first day the proposal was introduced, we knew the problem would be in the State Senate, and it is. The insurance industry is incredibly strong over there, and they are doing absolutely everything they can to fight it. But, you know, it's an election year, and sort of a bad place to be on the side of the insurance industry. You should go ahead to face the polls. So, you know, I think we have some reasonably high hopes. And that's sort of where we are. We have about 45,000 members have signed up online to join our coalition. We've sponsored events across the Commonwealth. We finally reached 4,500 churches have signed up to support this. We have, I think in the last count, we're about three people short in the State Senate of getting this passed. Now, three doesn't sound like very many until you're trying to get those last three. But we do have some pretty high hopes, and we're going to spend the next couple of weeks pushing for it. There is the program, the big fight for expansion of health care is that there are some people who just plain don't want to do anything. There are people who want to do something, but not if it would help Ed Rendell. And there are people who want to do their own thing. There are some people who are ideologically opposed to the governor's proposal. They really do believe that tax credits are the way to go. There are people who believe that single payer is the way to go. So we're trying to work with them to make sure that as many people as possible realize that there are lots of good ideas, but in government, as in life, what we're trying to do is get the best result, not the perfect result. And again, I think by last count we're at three more people, so if you know anybody, you think you know somebody. And then we have the insurance reforms, and the insurance reforms are going to be a different kind of fight. The insurance reforms basically would for the first time, regulate health insurers, which we don't have right now, their rate-setting ability. The insurance department in Pennsylvania can regulate homeowners insurance, auto insurance, basically every type of insurance except health insurance. So they just set their rates, and it sort of is what it is, and you get what you get. And they would change that. They would also go to community rating, and they would eliminate the ability to bounce somebody out of coverage because of a pre-existing condition. Those are all very, very big changes. And the insurance industry hates them all. So we're fighting on two fronts, and we've got about, I think, about 6 weeks to get it done. Again, if you know anybody, think you know somebody, just start calling them. So, thanks.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dan. Any particular people we should target for the audience?
Sure. Suburban Republicans around here. Dominic Pileggi, who's out in the suburbs, who is one of the Senate leaders. Ted Erickson, who's also out in the suburbs. I would start with them. The rest are in the center part of the state or out west. So.
Thanks, Dan. Well, I'm just going to throw some numbers at you. And actually, I've had, you know, been very fortunate to work with Dan's team in the governor's office as well, and with a whole group of us working on the nurse practitioner part of the legislation, which is very important, and you'll see it in context of what I'm going to briefly talk to you about this evening. And good evening, everyone. Think about this. 11 million people at this point that are on Medicare report that they cannot go to a family physician or a doctor because they won't take Medicare. 47 million Americans, is actually probably closer to 49 million Americans at this point, are still uninsured and report they don't have access or very little access to primary care providers. Only 70% of the American population, that means 70% of you in this audience, can go and see a doctor today or tomorrow if you need to. That means only 30% of you in this audience have access to a primary care provider and primarily a doctor if you need it. But again, I guess 9 months ago, Massachusetts passed a health care reform initiative, which was great. It provided 340,000 of their residents, primarily adults, with access to health insurance. But guess what? They're not taking into consideration the fact you also need providers to actually meet that gap, which meant that right now there's about a 6 to 9 month waiting list to be seen. Even if you have an insurance card in Massachusetts now, I've gotten it through this initiative, you can't go and see your physician. There are no providers. The difference in Pennsylvania is, I think, very strategically, is that they, you know, the leadership in Pennsylvania looked at capacity. What do we need? And we need to look at all the available providers that we have in a state. What Pennsylvania did was they looked at nurse practitioners and physician assistants, but primarily nurse practitioners, and they said, well, here is a group of providers that are highly skilled and educated. They are actually considered primary care providers in their own right. We want to find a way to open or make their restrictions, or get rid of the restrictions in terms of how they operate. So why don't we utilize nurse practitioners and other non-physician providers? Well, let's talk a little bit about the numbers. We probably don't have, you know, we can't afford not to. Only about 30% of residents or medical school students at this point report they have an interest in going into primary care. Last year, about half of our slots, about, you know, they had 2,600 slots in medical schools that had to be filled. Only 1,100 of them were filled in primary care. That meant we had close to, you know, 2,300 slots that were not filled. And, you know, the way we dealt with that gap was to try and get foreign educated physicians into the country and fill the gap that way. And we do that with waivers and all kinds of other things. However, what we are not doing very well sort of nationally, and I'll say Pennsylvania is, you know, is certainly the outlier here. We do that very well here. But in the rest of the country, we're not looking to a very qualified healthcare workforce that are nurse practitioners, that about 146,000 of them out there every year, between 3,700 to 6,500 of them graduate. They have master's degrees in nursing, and many of them doctorates in nursing practice, and they're considered primary care providers and can really do about 90% of what a family physician can do. They work in your physician's offices. They work in hospitals. And two places I particularly want to talk about where they work and have done excellent work and superb work is in the Nurse Managed Health Centers and the retail-based clinics you may have heard of, clinics that are in Walmarts and CVS and Walgreens and some of your local pharmacies. In the Nurse Managed Health Centers that have been around for about 30 years, so just to put a context of where they are, they provide primary care, health promotion, disease prevention services to primarily vulnerable populations. So people that are uninsured, children that are uninsured or underserved, you know, adult seniors. They also are very good at, studies have shown they're very good at managing chronic illness and really keeping people out of hospitals and actually decreasing what we call emergency room utilization, or actually keeping people out of the hospitals and also making sure that they, you know, take less costly medication. So they're very cost efficient and have had incredible outcomes over the last 30 years. The other setting where you'll see more and more of them are in the retail-based clinics. You may have heard about them. These clinics are, as I mentioned, in retail settings. And they're kind of a new phenomenon trying to address this issue of where do we get access to basic affordable healthcare services, the services that Massachusetts residents right now do not have access to, even though they have an insurance card. These clinics are opened, they're in a retail setting, so if you go to your local CVS or Rite Aid, they'll be right there. It's a clinic that looks like any doctor's office. You can be seen 7 days a week from 8 o'clock in the morning to about 8 o'clock or sometimes 10 o'clock at night. They'll treat you for your upper respiratory infection, they'll treat you for colds. The basic healthcare services, often, you know, the kinds of services where you kind of know what's wrong with you, but you need, you know, a qualified clinician to actually probably run a strep throat test or other tests to make sure that you don't need any antibiotics. The clinics are also very affordable. They're usually, the average cost of these clinics are about $60, and that's very affordable even to the many uninsured or people that are on high deductible health care plans where their deduction may be a lot higher than the $60 if they go to a regular primary care provider, or worse, which were the emergency rooms, where, which is the place where most people seek and get care these days. So keep, you know, what I want to sort of end, you know, with is just think about this again, 70% of all of you in this audience, so you can't get access to a regular primary care providers. We need to look at alternatives. Pennsylvania has done that very well, and nurse practitioners is one of those solutions.
All right, thank you. So I think it's important in this conversation just to take one step back and remember what it is we're really talking about, what this debate is really about that's going on here in Pennsylvania. That's certainly a debate that's raging across the nation as we're in the middle of a presidential election right now. These numbers are somewhat old and are probably higher now, but there's about 20,000 people in this country who die every year simply due to lacking health insurance. And those estimates take into account all the other sorts of factors that are associated with being uninsured, and really are the numbers that are directly attributable to people who live without access to health care as a result of being uninsured. And those are the things we need to keep in mind, I think, as we sit here and debate various approaches to health care reform and really think about what's at stake. Here in Philadelphia, there's about 160,000 people without health insurance. Those numbers have been climbing at a fairly rapid rate since 2000. We saw a little leveling off over the past couple of years, and it'll be interesting to see where we're at this year as we have new survey data come in later in the summer. But those numbers represented something along the lines of a 70% or so increase in the number of uninsured in this city in just a six-year period. And that is a really challenging situation for our city to deal with, regardless of what happens at the state level or at the national level. And we're fortunate here in our city to have roughly 30 neighborhood-based community health centers that provide, in most cases, very effective primary care. That said, there's many limits to this system. Many of these health centers are at breaking points financially. They have long waits. And patients who have very complicated medical conditions require more specialized care that these centers cannot provide. And so it raises serious questions about what the role is of our hospitals in the city, of our specialists in the city, of every working piece in the healthcare system. What is its role in addressing these gaps in care in Philadelphia. Because certainly we see families in this city who are working families facing financial devastation as a result of illness, and we need to keep that in mind. Now, I will tell you, I'm not here advocating a single solution to this problem. I think there's some important principles that we need to keep in mind as we listen to this debate and engage in it. We also need to keep in mind that we are on the doorstep of an incredible opportunity to make real changes in the healthcare system. And this doesn't happen very often. People who keep their eyes on this see that it's like once every 10 to 20 years, we have an opportunity to do something to fix healthcare. This is it. We're at one of those points. And to be blunt, we need to find a way not to screw it up. So I think there's a role here locally. There's a role at the state level, and there's certainly a role at the federal government. Locally, we need to find a way to develop some collaborative solutions to make our safety net work better for all Philadelphians. And the health department is providing tremendous leadership in trying to put together a collaborative body in the city that can make that happen. There's absolutely no reason why our hospitals, our health insurers, our large employers in the city, patients, government can't find a way to work together to try to make our resources go further. We have incredible assets in this city related to healthcare. At the state level, as Dan mentioned, there's already been legislation that has passed through our state house, is sitting in the state senate. The governor is ready to sign it. This is a real opportunity to offer health insurance to so many people in this state, 250,000 people who basically have no other options available to them. And there are real consequences to not acting on this. And then, of course, you know, you have to be living in a cave at this point not to hear about the presidential debates going on. And so certainly there's a very lively debate going on at the federal level that ultimately will move into the Congress after the presidential election. A key focus of healthcare reform must be affordability. A lot of the rhetoric you hear about consumer-directed healthcare is really code for making patients pay more out of pocket. And I think what we need to keep in mind is that an important principle is that family and patients' financial exposure in the healthcare system has to be based on their income. It cannot be just willy-nilly in the market where people are slammed with high healthcare costs that are a direct result of whatever their health status is. That people's economic situation has to be protected, and any good healthcare reform proposal will have to take into consideration people's income and rely heavily on public financing. So I'll close with saying, what will it take? I mean, we have seen healthcare reform proposals go up in flames many times. As I said, this only happens every 10 to 20 years. What has to be different this time? And I will say, it is all about political leadership. And it's about a strong governor. It's about a strong president who can build a political consensus. Because I can tell you, it's not about research. It's not about data. In order to overcome the huge money that is at stake with many of the special interests in healthcare, there needs to be a political leader that can build some consensus, can rally the public around an agenda that can't be hijacked by special interests. Thanks.
Thank you, David. My name is Carol Rogers. I'm here representing the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. And our mission is twofold, to protect and promote the health of Philadelphians and to provide a safety net for those most at risk. Now, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I'm wondering if people who themselves have been uninsured in the past year or have somebody close to them who's been uninsured in the last year could raise your hands. Okay, this is about what it equals in Philadelphia as a whole. The numbers of people living without health insurance in Philadelphia have risen by more than 50,000 people since the year 2000. Nearly one in four Philadelphia adults was uninsured for all or part of 2006. We're very lucky in this town to have Philadelphia Health Management as a household survey to ask people about their health status, so we're very lucky that we have this information. We know that more than 135,000 Philadelphia adults said that they were sick, but they were unable to seek medical care because they couldn't pay for it. More than 202,000 Philadelphia adults said that they were given prescription medications that they were unable to fill because they were unable to pay for it. Sadly, these figures are even higher for people with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, or hypertension, and I'm sure everybody here knows how important those conditions are to make sure that you have adequate ongoing health care. Now, the health department, we, honest to God, we don't really care about health insurance. What we care about is health. But in this country, the way to get good health, or at least one safeguard for good health, is health insurance. And that's because health insurance enhances the full range of preventive, chronic, and acute care services that we can get. And because uninsured people are more likely to receive too little medical care and to receive it too late. People without insurance get fewer preventive services. As David said, well, David's younger than me. He's a little more up on the numbers. He said 20,000 people a year die in this country because they just don't have health insurance. We have some recent data that shows that two people in the state of Pennsylvania die every day just because they do not have health insurance. Now, in 2006, Gallup poll asked Americans, what is the most number one troubling issue for you as an American? And 68% of people said the availability and affordability of health care. We in Philadelphia were a little bit ahead of the country as a whole, because in 2003, if you voted during that election, I can bet that you probably voted in favor of a ballot question which changed the Philadelphia Home Rule Charter to state that because health care is an essential safeguard of human life and dignity, the health department shall prepare a plan for universal health care that permits everyone in the city to get decent health care. And I'd like to acknowledge the work of many people here who were very active. And I'll tell you, once the question was on the ballot, it was not real hard. People voted for it. People voted for it in such strong numbers. But the real hard work was the people that got it on the ballot in the first place, which was people from the Committee to Defend Healthcare. I know I can't see that well from here, but I can see a lot of you out here, and, of course, Dr. Walter Sue. If you look at a map of how people voted on that charter change amendment, you can lay over any preventable health problem in the city of Philadelphia, you name it, whether it be lack of health insurance, whether it be unimmunized children, whether it be childhood lead poisoning, and the maps would look almost identical, so that the neighborhoods that were suffering more from preventable health problems voted more in favor of that amendment, some places up to 97%. But there was no ward in the city, none at all, where people voted less than 57% in favor of that amendment. So we, the health department, we took it as a very clear mandate that people, Philadelphians, believe that everybody should have health care, not just citizens, not just people that are working, not just people who are under 18 years old, that everybody has a right to decent health care. And I have to say that, you know, if you look up the word decent in the dictionary, sometimes it says not quite up to standard. That's not the definition that we've been using. We've been using the Institute of Medicine definition of decent health care, which means that it's accessible, continuously responsive to patients, and provided with an effective health care system. So when we were driven by the voters to come up with a plan so that everybody could get health care, we went out and consulted with many of you. We were able to hire some extremely intelligent and people that had a lot of not only status and I'm talking about David Grandy, who's sitting next to me, who at the time was, while he was a practicing physician already, he was at the time a graduate student at the Woodrow Wilson School of, what's it called?
Public.
Thank you. Yes. And his whole team came up with a plan. It's called Decent Healthcare for All in Philadelphia, Local Leadership and Action. And, of course, the findings of the plan were what you would expect, that there's going to be a rapid growth in the number of uninsured, that there's a brisk increase in health spending, and that we're on the brink of a healthcare crisis. And the findings of David's report was that we can't have universal financing at the local level. We need national and state reform. but that, as David just mentioned, we can assume a unique leadership role by working together for universal coverage of decent health care for all Philadelphians by using existing resources and having as our mission that everybody get decent health care. So, and another recommendation was to build a strong, unified voice of advocacy for the city of Philadelphia for universal financing. So to that end, I think I would very much, so that we're working on a number of those. We're working on forming the local leadership collaborative, but we're also working on universal financing. And I have to say that even though I've been a single-payer advocate my entire adult life, and I do not feel that profiteering in healthcare is appropriate, I feel it should be outlawed, I am very strongly in support, and the health department is very strongly in support of Governor Rendell's ABC plan. And it's not that the single-payer legislation isn't almost perfect, because it is. The problem is that the single-payer legislation on a state level is not out of committee yet. And ABC is out of committee, and it's already been voted on in the House, and it's going to the Senate. And even though it's not the perfect plan, it will expand the benefits of health insurance to about 225,000 to 50,000 Pennsylvania adults. And so think of the people that you know. Now, people want health insurance, and I think people that don't have health insurance are more concerned about having the protection that health insurance brings than they are about how it gets financed. So while I strongly support single-payer, and I love the single-payer coalition in the state, many of my good friends, I really hope that people will not only call their legislators, but also if you live outside Philadelphia, as Dan said, we really need to focus attention on the Republicans outside the city. We did a lot of work early in this fight so that the Pennsylvania House, the Philadelphia delegation in the House was strongly in favor, and they were able to stand up on that floor and really talk eloquently about the fact that their people back at home, us in Philadelphia, really think that we have to get to a point where we insure poor people. My understanding, and I'm not a finance person, I'm a healthcare person, is that while ABC will cover 250,000 people initially, if we have a change in the administration in Washington, if we get a Democrat in office, that will automatically be expanded to include thousands more people because it will be up to 300% of the federal poverty level. So I would urge you, I hope we all will fight for universal single payer on a national level. I would love to see it on a state level, but in the short term, please contact your legislators and tell them that you're in support of it's House Bill 1137. Senate, I know. I'm sorry.
Senate Bill.
Thank you, Walter. and I know that a number of people, the health department works in coalition with many different people, people that represent the uninsured, uninsured people themselves, healthcare providers, many others. There are a number of representatives from that coalition here. It's nice to see you all, and I hope that people will talk about why they're supporting this when we get to the floor. So thank you. Thank you all so much.
Hi, I'm Tom Getson, and I'm a health economist, and it's really nice to be facing a room full of people who are really interested. Usually when I talk to a group, the first question that you get afterwards is this going to be on the exam? And no, it's going to be something different. And for those of you who can't read, I know my eyes are getting worse. I always feel I need a disclaimer when I'm introduced as Dr. Getson. As my young son once said, but you're not a real doctor. You're just a money doctor. I'm a healthcare person. I'm a finance person. Unfortunately, for those who did sit through the exam, there's actually not a lot of economic theory in healthcare. There is on the exam, but not really in what we're talking about today. What there is in healthcare is an awful lot of problems which are political problems that involve money. Not really economic theory problems, but they are political problems that do involve a lot of money. And that really makes me think about what the choices are and who's going to make those choices, which is a difficult problem because, as a health economist, it shouldn't be me. I don't think in general people want accountants, insurance executives, certainly not economists, making decisions about what their health care should be. Who should be making those decisions? Most crucially, it's really the public. And I think it's important in that regard to distinguish between the public, which we all are, and patients. I think it's really difficult for a patient to make decision about what kind of health care is going to be offered in America and to make those hard choices about who's going to get this and who's not going to get this. I'm an economist. We're there to talk about a lot of the difficult stuff, which usually says if you want more of this, then you have to take from this. And none of us facing a medical crisis wants to say, oh, my kid is sick, but Walter's kid should get the care instead of my kid's. Somebody's got to make those choices. I nominate Walter. Seriously, it's the public and it's the medical community and the medical profession that's got to make the hard choices. They're going to have to step up at some point. These are not fun choices. They're things that nobody wants to do, but it's going to require that. It cannot happen, I know, from the point of view of the economist. That's not going to make it happen. It may happen to some extent with a political vision. Although I think, really, in all deference, that the real genius political decision is going to be the person who's able to come up with a healthcare plan which is going to conquer America by stealth, by allowing people to make choices so that they end up with the kind of healthcare system that all of us know we need. When we go out and do opinion surveys, we know that most people favor that all Americans could get some kind of a base level of health care, but not necessarily everything. And then the fighting starts. Where is the base and kind of what is there? But frankly, there is a great consensus. Probably what we would need to put forth a universal plan, 70-80%, that everybody deserves some kind of basic health care, but that we can't afford all the bells and whistles. We're going to have to work in that kind of a context, and I think the most effective way of working in that context will again be something where people are led to it. I don't think it can be imposed, and I don't think that any analysis or something that a policy group can come up, even at the Woodrow Wilson School, can get 80% of the people behind it, which is what we would need now. Given that we're going to need that, and that I'm an economist, what's my role here? Some of you may have heard that occasionally even our premier politicians make fun of economists. This week one of our presidential candidates talked about the gas tax, and when questioned about, can you name one credible economist who believes that this is a good idea, replied, yeah, economists, they're totally out of touch with people's feelings. Usually this is what I have to take from my family. But it's true. It's true. Economists are the people who are out of touch with the nice, easy solutions we'd all like to jump on and that would be lots and lots of fun and wouldn't cause any pain. We're the ones who go and say, if you want this, you got to give up that. It's going to cost something. You're going to have to make compromises. You're going to need to do all those things. I don't know what the answer is. I'm constantly embarrassed. Is there anyone here who's ever, ever been to the hospital and said they like health insurance? And I'm a professor of health insurance. I've been in the field for 30 years. And I don't have the answers. I think that the way we get to those answers, though, are we say, okay, what are the choices that we're going to make? One of the choices, everybody's got to have some basic level, and it can't cover everything. That we don't ask people as patients to make those choices. It's unfair. You don't call 911, throw somebody in the back, and then start going with where's your insurance card, which place do you want to go? This one's $84.95 an hour, and this one's $23. No. You don't do that. And Walter and the other physicians up here, let's get the physicians to step up and do what they're going to need to do, because making those allocations of the scarce financial resources of this country and allocating taxes is going to require leadership from the medical profession, not just from the White House or Congress. So I don't have the answer, but I have some vague idea that those might be ways that we might get a little closer.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you made those comments, because I do think I do have the answer. It's a properly financed single-payer system. It's the one that's been commented before. I want to start off by saying that the healthcare system in America is, you know, it costs too much, it covers too few, and it hurts too many people. And the general feeling is that the entire system is broken. And the fact is that you couldn't possibly create a more bureaucratic, more wasteful, more inefficient system than what we have in America today. It is only by the miracle that we spend 50% more per capita on health care that we have even some modicum of decent quality care for many people. But increasingly, we're seeing even that quality going down. So the health care system is an incredible waste of money the way it's set up right now. And it's one that I think Americans sort of have this great frustration. They know that something's wrong with their system. They like their doctors. But they know that intuitively something is wrong out there and it has to be fixed in some way. The problem is that I often start my talks by saying that we as Americans know more about Britney Spears than we know about how the American healthcare system works. And that's not by accident. I mean, if you think about what the media has been concentrating on in terms of this presidential election about, you know, right and flag lapels and all this other stuff, you can see that we have not actually advanced, despite what we've heard. We have not advanced too much about what the debate should really be about health care. And so I'm going to put forward to you what the real elephant in the room is, which is what should be the role of the private insurance industry in America. That really is the elephant in the room. The truth is that all the proposals that we've been hearing up to now basically endorse the idea that there's really not much we can do about it. They're too large. They're too entrenched. The pharmaceutical industry is too big. And therefore, we can't do anything about them. And so we have to live with the sort of monster we've created in America, which is this enormous for-profit insurance system, which sucks, you know, somewhere between 25% off, 25, 30% off the top for their own administration and profits and so on and marketing things. And then, you know, we sort of scrape around as physicians and hospitals and nurse practitioners for the scraps that are out there for the remaining amount of money. And the truth is that at a time, I don't mind if that happens, if everyone's covered with decent health care, but at a time when 47 million have no health insurance and some people are making, like Bill McGuire, the head of United Healthcare, $1.6 billion, one man himself, $1.6 billion in stock options for his corporation at United Healthcare, there is something egregiously immoral about that. Now, we have got to get smart about this in America and start realizing that the healthcare system cannot persist the way it is right now. And we know that we can do better because virtually every other country that we hear about, France and Germany, England, Canada, Taiwan, all these other countries, do a better job of providing health care for all their citizens, not just some, but all their citizens, than we do. What's part of the secret for them? Well, for one thing, they heavily regulate the private insurance industry, or they have decided to eliminate the private insurance industry and told them they cannot compete for basic medical services that is part of their health plan. And that actually is something that we have never got advanced to the discussion point at our presidential level. But we have got to do this, because the truth is that if we don't, we're going to be stuck for the next 4 to 8 years, assuming who even if we elect any of our Democratic candidates, with the current, you know, pharmaceutical, private, medical, industrial complex that is set up right now, with its all its for-profit nuances that are put in place here. And American people have got to start getting smart about this and saying, this has got to change. Now, there are two bills out there that I want to mention in the 2 minutes left that I have. One is H.R. 676. This is a National Health Insurance Bill, the U.S. National Health Insurance Act, which has currently 90 co-sponsors. It has the most number of co-sponsors of any universal health care plan in Congress right now. And interestingly enough, it's a single-payer plan for the United States of America, and is Carol has stated before, she fully endorses the idea that we should have a national health insurance plan for this country. Turns out that Governor Rendell actually thinks that we should have a national health insurance plan. Unfortunately, both our major candidates, McCain, Clinton, and Obama, none of them have actually come out and said we need to do this yet, and partly because they themselves are afraid of challenging the private insurance industry. The second one that challenges the private insurance industry is the one in the Pennsylvania House and Senate, which is House Bill 1660 and the Senate Bill 300 in the Pennsylvania Senate, which is called the Family and Business Health Security Act, which would also create a single-payer bill in Pennsylvania. Now, it's stated that you can't really do this in Pennsylvania because it seems somewhat unrealistic to try to do something like this. But the truth is that, you know, it's almost like a chicken and egg question. You know, the federal government says, we'll prove that it can happen in a state, and then we'll think about trying to do it at the national level. And the people at the state level say, well, prove that you can do it at the national level because this is too big a problem to do at the state level. And the truth is that nobody gets anything done because nobody's willing to take the first step. And we have an opportunity, frankly, in Pennsylvania to either support the state bill or convince more of our state, more of our federal congressmen people, including people like Alison Schwartz, Patrick Murphy, Joe Sestak, and Jim Gerlach in our immediate area to support the H.R. 676, the U.S. National Health Insurance Act, because that actually is what would radically change and transform this country in terms of how we think about health care. And until we get to the point where Americans start thinking less about Britney Spears and flag lapels and all this and starting thinking more about what is really what they want in a healthcare system, a system that actually should not discriminate based on whether you're black or white, rich or poor, young or old, suburban or urban, abled or disabled, a system that actually should be for all Americans, something that every other country in the world does, something that we could be proud of. Until we get to that point, we will not solve the healthcare problem in America. Thank you.
Our panel. All right, so we now we come to the entertainment portion of our evening, where your good questions will be taken. I think we're going to have raise your hands. I'll call on you, and someone will have a microphone that you can use so we can hear your questions. And I'll try and mix it up and make sure different people get a chance to come in on the answers. So man in the red up here. Yeah, he's raise your hand so they can get you a no problem.
I'm Henry DeSilva, and I have worked with Walter Sue. I just want to point out a couple of things. One is President Truman did try to put in a national health care insurance bill in 1945, and it was or in the mid-40s during his term, and it was quickly overridden as a communistic leaning of his. So it was defeated, and that was, in fact, supported by the American Medical Association. So there was a president who was in favor of a national healthcare health reform at that time. Nevertheless, there have been articles more recently pointing out how people, and one was in the May 4th issue of the New York Times, pointing out how even the insured are having a hard time with getting health insurance to cover what is necessary. And that was a headline article pointing out the people who have health insurance, how deductibles are going up, etc. And there is no real good way of dealing with that. And in addition, we haven't heard about what we popularly call the underinsured, people who have insurance and whom now standard health insurance is moving in the direction of underinsuring people in large numbers. So we need a bill that really addresses this issue, not just that of providing health insurance coverage, but actually providing appropriate coverage so that people can afford to meet their medical expenses and not run in to examples as pointed out by the New York Times, by Newsweek recently, and by the PBS Frontline that was done on, I believe, April 15, 2008. So we need to make sure that these new proposals address this issue. In the Frontline series, I believe, Reid traveled to about six different countries, including Germany, Switzerland, Japan, etc., and pointed out what works there and why we don't want to learn what works in another country and adopt that into proposals for reform here is really, I believe, the shame goes to the insurance industry that
Okay, thank you. Let me see if we have any response from the panel. Anybody?
I'll just make one brief comment. I think the issue about people not really knowing what the heck their insurance will do if they get sick is a very real one. Who can really read through insurance contracts and understand the implications of what that means if one actually comes down with an illness? I think it raises, that concern alone, I think, raises serious questions about, for example, what John McCain has proposed, which is really to put more people out into a less regulated private individual insurance market, where people would be expected to essentially figure these things out on their own. While it sounds like a neat idea to be able to purchase insurance across state lines, essentially what that means is you're taking away states' ability to regulate the insurance market because people can just purchase insurance from another state.
Yes.
And I'd just like to say you were mentioning other countries, and I just was over in Denmark running a conference there, and I think they have a really neat healthcare system in Denmark, but it's a different country than the United States. I live in Mount Airy, and I think if Mount Airy were to be a nation and create its national health agency, it might look a lot like the Swedish or the Danish healthcare
system.
Probably
will. You'd have very high usage.
But we also have Montana and Tennessee, and any good healthcare system that's going to cover all of America, it's going to somehow have to bring us all in.
Thank you. Yes, sir, down here in the...
I'd like to press you, please, Dr. Getson, on that point, because it seems to me that health economists could play a way more clarifying role in this debate than up until now, based on comparative economics. No matter how affectionate one might feel toward the market, there's still the question, can the U.S. afford a private healthcare system? It might be, since you point out that scarcity is one of the things that is a bedrock of your profession. Why not put to the American people, can we afford a private healthcare system, or are we driven to making a choice whereby single payer is the only thing that we could possibly afford in order to get the job done? I don't see why that wouldn't be professionally something economists could help us figure out.
Well, if I could just quickly defend, I've been 30 years in the health economics business, and it's only been in the last 10 that the first question or disbelief I didn't get from a journalist is, what do you mean we don't have the best healthcare system in the world? We've worked really hard at doing comparative healthcare economics, and we've got some people, we have some comparative statistics that come out so that many more people now do know that it's more expensive in the United States. And it's not necessarily the best system in the world. And that's come a long way. Has it got us all the way there? I don't think so. But I'm not sure that health economists per se are going to be the ones that are going to convince people. I think we've done a little bit just by getting people to understand that there are options out there, because there were many years when all these other systems were demonized, and we just sort of immediately assumed that the U.S. healthcare system was better than all the others. So at least we've woken up a little bit.
Right. Let's see. Ma'am. Wait for the mic, if you would. Thank you.
My name is Linda Beckman, and I'm in HCAP, which is Healthcare for All Philadelphia. That's our new name. Walter is in that group. I want to emphasize that the various countries of the world, which are certainly more diverse than Mount Airy and Montana, diverse as those are, all essentially approach health care in the same way. There are very many variations, but they all do it essentially without the health without the profit-making health care industry. It's not, they don't all have what we would call single payer, but it is so striking to me that all of them do it without health care being a profit-making industry. The only country that I even know of, this 87, that has profit-making companies is Switzerland, and what I learned on Frontline was that those companies are not involved. They don't make a profit on basic care, only on things like whether you get a double room or a single room. And so it seems to me that the countries of the world have found the single answer, Dr. Grand. They have figured out that there's only one thing that works, which is to get rid of the elephant in the room, the profit-making industry.
I'm actually, if you detected an accent, I'm Danish by background, but I'm proud of you, a citizen. But I actually think that, you know, we should not be fooled with what's going on in a lot of the Western countries. There's actually a two-tier system. Let's take Denmark. Yeah, they have a single-payer, you know, system, and everybody has access. It's an excellent system, and I'm very proud to. I think I'm healthy because I grew up in it. They had a prevention focus. So, you know, but what's happened is that you're now developing, the last 10 years, you've had sort of more private sector development. We now have private hospitals in Denmark, and Denmark's not the only country. You have private specialty providers. So people are shopping around. People are buying supplemental health insurance, which is a private market. So I think, you know, yeah, there's a single payer system, but it's kind of interesting. Some of our ideas of how to provide health care has now migrated into some of these Western countries because people are not happy about the lack of access in that single payer system. So it's part of, you have to think about that as we talk about it, but it's kind of interesting. It's just a point to make when we talk about, you know, foreign countries.
The doctors that I know who practice in England feel that privatization is in fact eroding what were once excellent systems that are less excellent. And so I think that, in fact, is probably what you're talking about. And maybe there should be some private insurance that's available in addition to the national health care that's available to everybody. Perhaps that's so. That's another debate. But there really is only one thing that works that is affordable. And what I wanted to say is this. If you use insurance companies, universal health care for all is not affordable. It's not working out that well in Massachusetts because of that reason. And if the health care plans of Hillary Clinton or Obama were to go into effect, they would not work because they would not be affordable. We are kidding ourselves. And I guess I have to wonder why. I mean, I know that the people who support the Rendell plan are sincere, and I can follow their arguments. And in some ways, it's hard for me to be against that because give a little bit, you know, have it, that maybe it's better than nothing unless it prevents us from ever getting national health care. If that's the price, that's too high a price, because every month about 4,000 people are becoming uninsured in Pennsylvania alone, and we're not going to be able to keep up with the people becoming rapidly uninsured, not to mention the underinsured. And I'll stop here. It's hard to stop, but I'll stop.
Do we have any free market advocates, any naysayers? It seems like we all agree a little bit too much. Anybody want to dare to? Free market advocate down here? Second. Here comes the mic.
Thank you. I don't know that I'm an advocate, but one of you mentioned, at least in my notes I have it, that you need to have some hard-driving politicians that would be in the forefront of getting health care for everyone. And I wonder if you'd expand on that, because it seems to me one thing the insurance companies need is some sort of cap on what they can do. In the same way that they capped doctors recently. And so it's not so much an advocate as these are things that we deal with every day, and I wish you would address that or whoever mentioned it.
Any thoughts on capping or regulating what insurance companies can do?
Well, I think speaking broadly, I mean, I made the point about the role of strong political leadership. And if you look at, you know, back in history about big things that have happened in this country in terms of major legislation, what you often find is that there's years of laying the groundwork that happens where you have advocates working hard on an issue, you have policy people who have sort of floated different ideas around, but where the window of opportunity opens up are often major elections and a new presidential agenda, a crisis of some sort, which I don't think we're going to have the kind of crisis in healthcare that has the kind of, you know, you're not going to have a natural disaster that makes the Congress do something in healthcare, or I would hope not. So what are those windows of opportunity politically? I think it's political leadership that emerges from a presidential election that is able to begin to build some consensus with some crossing of parties, which will be necessary. I mean, for the foreseeable future, it's hard to imagine a landscape in Washington that doesn't require some bipartisanship to get something through. And it's going to require a special person who can do that. I have feelings about who that is. You can guess. But I think it's critical to advancing this issue. I will say one other thing just in response to some of the earlier comments. I am a strong supporter of single payer. I believe in it strongly. But I think the more critical component here is a strong element of public financing that protects people economically. And it may not be perfect in terms of affordability as a nation, but I think if some of the plans that Clinton and Obama have put forward have a strong path in them that could lead to single payer with a very strong public program in there as a choice, I think that would be a good compromise.
Great. This lady up here on the left side here.
Hi. I'm a 30-year-old woman. My name is Ursula Burton. Okay, I came to the seminar because I was reading the Metro the other day or whatever, and I decided that I was going to come, voice my opinion, because I'm tired. I'm a single woman with no kids, and they would not give me health care. Excuse me, I don't mean to cry because it just hurts, but they didn't give me health care for a long, long, long time, and I'm tired, and like, I just want to know, like, why do they do not give single women anything no more? Like, I mean, it's hard for me every day, you know, to go by and without no health care. And, like, it hurts. I have to, like, do things on my own, like, by, you know, and I'm just tired. And I need some health care, babe. And I don't know what to do anymore. So I figured that I would come in and, you know, sit in and see what's going on to see if somebody can help me get some health care because I'm tired of not know everybody turning me away. Like, I know that I'm independent and I'm supposed to be, you know, independent and do everything the right way, but it's just hard. And I tried to go to Keystone Mercy back when I was a teenager because some type of way my mom got my medical cut off. And they wouldn't give me anything. So I'm 30 now. I survived. I just want to know, how can I get some health care?
I will be very happy to, if you want to wait until the end of the program, I will come and talk to you, and I will tell you about some of the programs at the health department, try and get you some care. I'm happy to do that. I would like to say that the Philadelphia Department of Public Health works very hard, and I would like to acknowledge the long and hardworking career of Barbara Capizio, who worked for many years providing health care in our health centers. Our health centers are free. They are mandated by legislation that was passed by all of us, again, to change the charter. Maybe that's where you got the idea to change the charter. We have 8 comprehensive health centers. They're free for any Philadelphia resident. There are long waits. We are hiring quite a bit of additional staff with our new health commissioner. And even though you wait a long time, once you get to see your clinician, you will get excellent care. You will not have to pay for anything. It doesn't matter what your income is. If you have insurance, that's great. We also provide free medications for people. So that's a reason why some people that may be underinsured come to our health centers. And if you wait for me at the end of the program, I'll come and talk to you.
Okay. Yes. See, over here, this man. Right there. Yeah.
My question has to do with the relationship of the state health plan with the national health plan. Now, suppose the state plan, Senate Bill 1137, gets passed. State of Pennsylvania now has a health plan. The next president agenda is, suppose it is, to have a national health plan. How does that work? Does the state oppose the national health plan? Will the state be able to work with the national government in the formation of a national health plan? How will that mesh?
Well, two things. One is basically no matter who gets elected in November, a national health care plan is probably at a minimum 5 years from being implemented. It'll take a while to get passed. It'll take a while to get the regulations written. It'll take a while to actually get up and running, which is why one of the reasons that the governor has been pushing it even during an election year in which we have some major party candidates who say that they are focused on it. You know, we shouldn't wait 5 years and sort of let people hang out there with no insurance if we can do something about it until then. To answer your question directly, though, the plan is actually built so that it will mesh with whatever the federal government does. This is stepping into a breach where private insurance is not picking up and public insurance is not picking it up. But, you know, it is a private sector-based plan. It is employer-based for the most part because the vast majority of the people who are uninsured in Pennsylvania work full-time, and it is not – or full-time equivalent, and it's not a question that they don't want insurance. It's that they can't afford insurance. That's why one of the goals of the governor's plan is to reduce the costs of health insurance, whether it's getting rid of preventable errors or getting rid of or more tightly controlling the insurance industry. None of the candidates running are talking about anything other than a private sector-based plan. So this will mesh right into it, and it's designed to.
Yeah. They're not talking about it yet.
Well, then it'll be 15 years before something gets passed. There are people out there who are ideologically opposed to a single-payer plan, and the way that the government is set up is that one person in the United States Senate can stop it. And so, you know, I think that one of the reasons, and the governor has always been very clear that he would love to see a single-payer at the federal level, but he's not going to, you know, basically say that people should go without insurance until he gets the perfect plan passed. And what do you say to those 250,000 people who could get insurance in the next couple of years, but you want single payer? Do you want to say, well, too bad, we shouldn't do this, we should hold off? The governor has always been very clear that anyone who wants to do that, I mean, great, but that's sort of not his role. I mean, his role is to, you know, even if it's not a leap, take the step forward.
And can I just ask, what do you say to the uninsured people in the room? I mean, I think that the discussion about where we want our country to go is a really important one, and we have to have a vision for what we want. But people have to survive in the meantime. People are not doing very well. If you look around, people are dying from things that are completely preventable.
See, the man up here, about halfway up, right on the aisle.
You wanted somebody to speak in behalf of the existing healthcare system. May I explain that this is my Republican alter ego, who was raised in our suburbs by the name of H.D. or Dewey Cheatham. We have in the United States today a $2 trillion business, which is called healthcare. And as some of you have pointed out on the panel, 25 to 30%, as a matter of right, is what we take from that system every year and distribute to our boards of directors, our shareholders, and everyone else who is entitled to make a profit from from your diseases and your illnesses and your injuries. We do this because this is the American way. Because under capitalism, under this economic system, we are engaged in a struggle against every other nation in the world, and only the fittest have a chance of survival. That's it. It is unfortunate, most unfortunate, that 18,000 Americans die every year because they cannot afford health insurance. It saddens me. But it pales in comparison with the 100,000 Americans who die every year, who have insurance, go into the hospital, and are killed because of a medical mistake. So, if you're uninsured, your chances of survival are about four times as high. So, and we want to thank the government of Pennsylvania for opening the state treasury to help us collect insurance premiums on behalf of some of your least insurable people. That essentially is your health care system speaking to you. My only question is, what are you prepared to do about it? Yes.
Can I tell you, I mean, thank you. One of the great things about being in healthcare is it's a growing, expanding. I look up here and see almost everybody, not quite everybody. We're the largest employer in Philadelphia's healthcare. And one of the things that we, everybody sitting at this table, has to recognize that if we're going to deal with this crisis and get healthcare costs under control, some of us are either going to have to take a pay cut or lose our jobs, which is one reason health care reform is really tough. Every time we talk about something, somebody's ox is going to get gored. So, you know, look left, look right. Since, you know, you don't have textile mills or steel mills in Philadelphia anymore, but you do have health care, and if we do a good job, we're going to hurt some people.
Walter, do you support the Rendell plan?
Do I support? I'm neutral on the Rendell plan because of the issues. I mean, what I mean is that I hear actually what Dan and Carol and David have all said, and there one should not maybe speak ill against one fellow health activist. So I respect the fact that they are working hard for the plan. I think that my belief is that we ought to vote for what we really would want. And, you know, if I were a union organizer, I don't go into the bargaining table with my compromise plan. I go into the union table starting with what I really want. And maybe I would end up settling with a plan that's similar to Pennsylvania ABC. But that's my perspective, and maybe I'm naive about it and from a tactical perspective, but I believe that's how I think about it.
Let's see here. Man over there on the black, he's had his hand up for a while.
Thank you. I'm a member and a speaker for Physicians for a National Health Plan, and I come from New Jersey, so I'm not sure. Is the Pennsylvania plan a mandate plan like the state of Massachusetts?
No.
No.
No penalties for the people who are caught without it?
No.
Nope.
Okay. Well, I'll just close by saying that Dr. Walter there echoes my sentiments completely. I believe that with incrementalism, we put off the resolution of our healthcare crisis that we need now. Every layer of incrementalism means a whole new layer of administrations. And we have, with the increase in physicians from 1970 to 2005, approximately 200% increase. And the increase in administrators is approximately 2,500%. And this is just going to be adding more and more until we get to what we really all know we need, which is a single payer. It's just putting off, I think, what's needed now. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen here.
Thank you so much. My name is Jonathan H. Bernard, and I'm a student at Temple University. I understand that we live in a global economy, and this was reaffirmed a couple of years ago when I heard President Bush's head economic person, Gregory Mankiw, said that exporting jobs and going overseas and going abroad is just something that American businesses and American consumers are just going to have to get used to. So my question, I'm sorry to say that. My question is when are the businesses going to start to step up, and why isn't there more outcry? Because you take a look right now, you're seeing that GM is not being able to compete against companies like Toyota, and Toyota has now taken the lead. If not out of altruism, why not out of just pure economic reasons for the companies domestically here to be advocating for more health care to help them compete globally against other countries and competitors?
A couple things. For some of the largest companies in the country are very active on the healthcare debate. The problem is that small businesses are not, despite the fact that they are the ones who are the most impacted. The majority of people are employed by small businesses, and if you go and talk to any legislator, they don't say that they're standing up for big business. They always say that they're standing up for small business. And I have a small business, and the fact is that you spend all of your time running a small business, and you know healthcare is expensive, but you know sort of adding another thing to your plate, it just doesn't happen. I mean it's difficult enough to do what you've got to do to make sure that your employees get paid and that your clients get serviced, and I mean I provide health insurance for my employees, but to go and there are a lot of people out there who are working, small business leaders who are working 75, 80 hours a week, and to go and be an activist, it's just too much for them. So that's sort of what it is. I mean, if you're married with kids, you're running your small business, and then you're going to go put in an extra 20 hours a week being an activist, it just doesn't happen. And you have some the entities that say that they are speaking for small businesses. NFIB, Chamber doesn't really say they are, but NFIB and some of the other small business things, they're insurance companies. That's where they make most of their money. They sell insurance to their members. So they go out there and they put out whatever their proposal is, and, that's all you ever hear about it most of the times. But, like, here in Pennsylvania, the NFIB is very, very active against any sort of health care reform. And they're also I think they spend half their time fighting health care reform and the other half fighting disclosure of how much money they make from selling insurance. So that's sort of the answer to your question. Big business is very interested in it, very, very interested in it.
Go ahead,
Keith. I actually think that companies are doing something, maybe, well, politically as well, but they're also looking at their workforce. I mean, I mentioned in my opening remarks that insurance is great, single-payer system may be great depending where you are, but you have to have an adequate, available workforce. Whatever, say, the primary care network, with physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, you name it, but you have to utilize your providers correctly. What we've seen with the larger private companies that they have, given their employees insurance, but they can't get appointments. They're out for a couple of days. They're non-productive. So more and more what we're seeing is that larger companies are doing their own on-site healthcare clinics or creating a separate system of healthcare access for their employees so they know that their employees can be seen right away and sometimes their families can be seen right away because they cannot afford to lose that productivity. So I just continue to say is that, we've talked more about insurance and the payment measure and mechanism for paying for access to health care, but we cannot forget the fact that we have a lot of, the gentleman said it up there, you actually have insurance, you have 98,000 people dying in the hospitals. We have to deal also with the provider side of it. What are we doing on that end? And I think, again, Pennsylvania has done a good job addressing that. But we also have to look at our workforce because we could end up with a single-payer system and not enough providers to provide care in it. And I think that's a piece of, sort of that elephant in the table that we also have to deal with. And one way employers are doing their own clinics in their work sites.
David, you were stepping up to say something.
Well, I was just going to, in response to the big business question, I think there's different kinds of big business. So there's more of the legacy employers who've been around for a long time, have a history of providing very rich, comprehensive benefits, who tend to be on the hook in many ways a lot more than, the Walmarts and other more service sector companies that have grown. And so I think you even have to slice up that sector to see who is really interested in engaging in these conversations and others who just don't see their role in healthcare as being very prominent.
Okay, let's see. Lady right in the center here. It's sort of like healthcare. You got to wait for good service. And
I think from all the discussion, first of all, it seems to be it's definitely a two-prong program. One is the workforce, and I think that that's an issue that Congress and legislators need to work on. I think they need to incent primary care providers. And in 1991, the Medicare fee schedule was passed, and the the resource-based relative value scale was put into place, which was supposed to reinforce the primary care physician that spent more time rather than the technical surgeon who, in fact, had very specific but time.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.